has a very predictable number of spectral components. All the odd harmonics will be there. The fundamental, the third, the fifth, the seventh, all the evens will be gone. And the average DC voltage is zero. Because I'm spending as much time positive as I do negative. Now I turn the knob on this pulse generator, the Hewlett-Packard pulse generator. I turn the DC offset knob. I crank it up plus 1 volt. So that now the exact same waveform that I used to have goes up to plus 2 volts and down to 0 volts. I've got the exact same waveform before. The peak-to-valley voltage is the same, just that I've done a DC voltage offset. I've moved the whole waveform plus 1 volt up. And I now look at the spectrum on a good spectrum analyzer. Because most spectrum analyzers have at the front panel a coupling capacitor, it will not see the 1 volt positive DC component. It's there, but the spectrum analyzer won't see it. The spectrum you see on the spectrum analyzer will be absolutely no change. If your spectrum analyzer didn't have that coupling capacitor on the front panel connector, and you put plus 1 volt into the front end of that spectrum analyzer, as you can do on some of the spectrum analyzers, let me drop. On some of the spectrum analyzers where the lowest frequency range is 0 to 2 gigahertz, and some of them do not have a DC coupling capacitor. And once you set the RF attenuator on the front panel to 0 decibels, the center conductor of that input connector goes directly to the front end doubly balanced mixer, and you're putting plus 1 volt into the diodes of that doubly balanced mixer. You have just wiped out that mixer. That's approximately the failure mode. If the RF attenuator is set at 0 and you put more than 1 volt into that front panel, that mixer is now you've blown out some of those diodes, they've become an open circuit, and you don't have a mixer anymore. And when I used to be in the spectrum analyzer business, I was amazed how many times I would see somebody send back the spectrum analyzer saying, hey, the first band doesn't work. And you ask the guy, what was he doing? Let me drop. And he'll tell you, I was doing troubleshooting. I had a piece of coaxial cable coming from that front panel connector. I was going to probe various portions of my radio that I'm troubleshooting to make sure that there was no DC voltage going into the spectrum analyzer. I had a coupling capacitor. I had a disc ceramic coupling capacitor connected to the center conductor of the end of the coax cable. And the shield of the coax cable was being grounded to the chassis of the radio I was testing. And he's walking along that circuit and he's touching various places to find out what the signal level is like. And he's looking at it on the screen of the spectrum analyzer. And he didn't realize it, but one of the things he touched was either a transistor or a tube that had, let me pick a number, either 20 volts on the transistor or 100 volts on the tube. And even though he had a coupling capacitor, and he said, hey, the DC is not going to get there. Oh, it did. He's got a 50 ohm load resistor on the spectrum analyzer side, and maybe he was using a 0.01 disc ceramic capacitor, and you and I could calculate what the time constant is. But at the instant he made contact to the 20 volts on that transistor collector, for some number of microseconds, he shoved 20 volts down that cable into that front-end mixer. And that front-end mixer can only tolerate that 1 volt offset for about a microsecond. And then the transistor and the diodes in the mixer are gone. So by way of the size of the coupling capacitor and the size of the voltage that he made contact to, the transient pulse he shoved down that line blew out that front-end mixer. Happens every day of the week. At 2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, I was trying to imagine a pulse modulation. Now, is square impulse considered to be summary of sine wave or just AC components? When we have a B hear modulation, I assume that pulse modulation is 100% positive. So, the square wave from pulsing is being used for the purpose of pulse modulating. Now, if we, another question that would be actually assigned to that is the square wave when pulsed requiring impedance matching network to the load, as then we no longer have a DC pulse, we have AC components in it. Back to you.
Yeah, if I take any of these nonlinear functions, I'm scratching wires together, I'm making square wave pulses, I'm making an upside down or right side up radar, I'm flipping switches on and off, I'm doing anything that makes a spectrum. And now I shove that through a low pass filter, a high pass filter, a band pass filter, what happens? I could, if I'm smart enough, make my impulse generator, and maybe I can make the impulse generator inside of a good sized box, and make the impulse generator something that it makes a 20 volts square wave, so to speak, and I put it through a attenuator so that what comes out instead of 20 volts is 1 volt. That would be a 13 decibel, or that would be a 26 decibel attenuator. So I've got this square wave generator that makes 20 volt pulses inside, and I'm putting it through a 26 decibel attenuator. What I get out are 1 volt pulses. But the advantage of using the attenuator, let me drop, is now the 50 ohm attenuator, because of its insertion loss, means that the Thevenin equivalent impedance of my signal generator is very close to 50 ohms. The advantage of using a 50 ohm attenuator with a whole lot of dBs, 26 dB is a whole lot of dBs, is that whether the pulse generator is instantaneously a short circuit or an open circuit while it's making those 20 volt pulses almost doesn't matter. When it's a short circuit and I look into it, I'll see 49 ohms of impedance. And when it's an open circuit, I'll see 51 ohms of impedance. But because of the presence of the attenuator, my signal generator, most of the time, almost all the time, looks like very close to a 50 ohm signal generator. That's a 1.01 standing wave ratio, if you know what I mean. That's the advantage of using a pad after any kind of a noise generating or pulse generating device. If you're really smart, you use a pad. And now I put that into a 50 ohm designed filter. And that filter could be a high pass filter, a low pass filter, or a band pass filter. Let me drop. But the advantage of what I've just done is the filter is very well designed as far as its impedance is concerned. The signal generator is very well designed as far as its impedance is concerned. And when that signal generator, without the filter, was put straight into a good 50 ohm spectrum analyzer, I recognized that signature. I recognized those individual spectral components, comb lines or all the odd components of a square wave, whatever. I had a very recognizable, very predictable waveform on the spectrum analyzer. And now I put it through that filter. What happens? Before I put it through the filter, before I put that waveform through the filter, I did a test of the filter itself. I found out that at the center frequency, the filter had no insertion loss. At the upper 3 dB roll-off frequency, it had 3 dB of roll-off, of insertion loss. And I keep walking down with my signal generator going into the filter. I found out the skirts of the filter go down 60 dB, and I recognize the shape of the filter. By sweeping the filter with a swept signal generator into some kind of a recording device, and I've now got a beautiful recording of the exact bandpass characteristics of that filter. And now I connect that filter to that particular signal generator that I just previously described with the attenuator. I knew exactly how strong every one of those comb lines was before I used the filter. I know exactly how many decibels the filter attenuates a signal at each one of the frequencies of every one of those lines coming out of that pulse generator. I lay the two on top of each other, so to speak. I now know exactly how strong every one of those spectral lines is going to be. They're going to be attenuated by the exact number of decibels that the filter did when I did the swept frequency test. I can predict ahead of time exactly what the spectrum's going to look like when I added the filter. But there's a catch.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So as long as I've got a real 50-ohm signal generator and a real properly designed filter, I can predict exactly what I'm going to get. But what happens if I didn't have that 26 decibel attenuator? There was a period of time when my pulse generator was an open circuit. There were periods of time when my pulse generator was a short circuit. And I connect that to a real filter that's made out of inductors and capacitors. Whoa. All hell breaks loose. At the instant of the time that the signal generator presents a short circuit, those first components of that filter, that first capacitor and that first inductor, it didn't see a 50-ohm source, it saw a short circuit. During that instant of time, that filter has an entirely new tuning characteristic. You've changed the filter. During the time it's an open circuit, it has a very different filter characteristic. And the way a filter works, a normal filter rejects frequencies by presenting a short circuit to those frequencies. When the attenuator was there, the frequencies that didn't get passed by the filter input connector, let me drop, like the lower skirt or the upper skirt of the filter passband, where the filter has very little passband, where it's got almost zero signal being flowing through, the filter must obey the law of conservation of energy. It presents a short circuit at those frequencies. So at some of the lower frequencies where the filter is not passing the signal is walking down that coax cable from the signal generator that doesn't have the pad into the filter. The filter can't pass those signals. It's a short circuit. It reflects them back. I've now got a ringing circuit. I've now got energy bouncing back and forth in that cable. So without the attenuator, without the 26 dB attenuator, I just directly connect this very discontinuous impedance signal generator into a real filter. I'm going to get a very complicated ringing response. The normal pass band, the normal stop bands, everything will be different. The situation is only defined if I've got a pure 50 ohm source of signal. In the case of the pure 50 ohm source signal, when I'm using the 26 dB attenuator, all the frequencies that the filter was rejecting, the filter at those frequencies represented a short circuit. That energy got reflected out of phase back toward the signal generator. The 26 dB attenuator absorbed 99.99% of that energy, and it's gone. The advantage of a pure 50 ohm source of signals, whether it be a signal generator, whether it be a pulse generator, or whatever, is that all reflected signals from your unit under test, in this case we're testing a filter, all reflected signals get absorbed, and you can now predict what's going to happen. If you didn't do that, the length of line between the signal generator and the filter, every time I change that length of line, I'd have a brand new characteristic.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So there's a lot of advantage of defining the impedances very well in the signals that are being generated and the things that are a load and so on. By using attenuators in the right place, a hell of a lot of testing starts making sense. And if you're naive enough not to put pads in the right places, every time you change the length of cable, you get a new response, and you say, what in the world is the real passband of that filter? I can make the filter look anything I want to, depending on what length of line I use between the discontinuous signal generator and the filter. So you got to be careful. And 2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, and to Jean, it is good to go once to the subject and finish it up, at least know everything possible about the subject. DC represents a resistance, not impedance. So when we're dealing with the DC square pulse that has zero offset, no negative part of it, question then is, for me it's a modulation. It's a false modulation. I have a load and I have a generator, high voltage generator. I set the voltage generated at 5,000 volts, DC of 100 kilohertz. Now I have a load. This is a very special generator that was made especially for the purpose of testing incandescent light bulbs. Do I need to have a matching network, impedance matching network? Now, I said, when we have a DC, then we don't deal with the impedance. But then we have a DC post with 100 megahertz. I'm sorry, kilohertz. Now, do I need a matching network or attenuator just to have a right voltage of, let's say, 4,000 volts at the load? At the load has different impedance than or resistance, if we're talking about tungsten, than the generator. Back to you.
Yeah, most light bulbs that are made for, say, a 115-volt circuit, you put 2,000 volts on that light bulb, and you're probably going to create a failure.
It was... John knows exactly what this was used. Maybe John can help us.
You would create a failure if you put 2,000 volts on that light bulb for any significant period of time. I could put 2,000-volt pulses into a 115-volt incandescent bulb without damaging the bulb if I did it with a low enough duty cycle. If I gave you a 2,000-volt pulse for one quarter of a microsecond and I did it once every half a second, the total amount of energy I'm putting into that incandescent filament could be small enough that I might get normal brilliance out of it. So when you're putting DC, high voltage DC pulses into something like a resistor or an incandescent filament, you've got to be very careful and calculate what is the duty factor. What percentage of the time are you doing it? And if you integrate for a full second, what's the total amount of energy delivered? If that was a 100-watt light bulb, and even though I'm putting 2,000-volt pulses in there, if the 2,000-volt pulses are brief enough, and if the rate at which I'm doing it is slow enough, so the 2,000-volt pulses represent a total energy per second of 100 watts, I'll get normal brilliance out of that light bulb. Change that pulse duration just a little bit, and all hell's going to break loose. I wonder if you can see that one, John. N2XJ, KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. It all has to do with watt seconds, without a doubt. This device he's speaking about is for gas discharge tubes for testing and also incandescent tungsten filaments, it looks like in the photograph that I've seen. Very interesting piece of equipment, but it also can be modulated by another generator, which you can put in there, and modulated for different pulses. It also has an igniter switch to boost the voltage, I guess, with gas discharge tubes. Very interesting piece of equipment. In fact, I'm waiting to get one myself, but that's what he's working with.
But now we got to be a little bit careful. Let me tell you about two kinds of nonlinearity. In the case of an incandescent filament, when it's cold, a 100-watt light bulb normally draws roughly 1 ampere. So it's got something close to 115 ohms of resistance when it's fully lit. But that cold filament is not 115 ohms. It's probably about 10 ohms. So it's got a very spooky startup characteristic when you're applying your RF energy to it or your pulses to it. So how much energy is really being delivered in the beginning when it's representing a 10-ohm resistance at the beginning of the event? You've got to be careful with that one. In the case of incandescent filament, as it gets hot, automatically it comes up to the 115 ohms, and after that, if your duty factor is right, it'll light normally. That's okay for an incandescent filament. But a A gaseous discharge is something else. Let me drop. When I get a breakdown of gas, which means the gas is now a plasma, and if you plot the voltage current characteristic of a neon bulb, a fluorescent bulb, or whatever, you'll find out it's got a huge nonlinearity in the other direction. As you try to put more voltage into it, then the amount of voltage that ignites the gaseous material inside, its internal resistance starts going down very fast. It's a negative impedance material. The reason why you've got a so-called ballast transformer on a fluorescent tube is that it is a kind of an inductive kickback, inductive circuit, trying to maintain constant current, not constant voltage, constant current through the filament, through the fluorescent tube. And if you do any kind of a change so that the current through the fluorescent tube increases, the voltage drop across the tube decreases. It's got that crazy negative characteristic to it. So if you really plotted voltage current characteristic, it would be a very crazy looking curve. So now when you're starting to put these 2,000 volt pulses on a, let's say, fluorescent tube that's made to run at something like 115 volts, and even though you've calculated that each one of the pulses is only a couple of microseconds long and is very few pulses per second, and you think the duty cycle is low because of the negative characteristic of the fluorescent tube during each pulse event, makes the voltage drop across the tube go to a very small number and the current during that instant go to a very high number, you may have naively calculated how many watts you're putting into this tube. You think it's a 40-watt fluorescent tube, and you think by the duty cycles you...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's a 40-watt, 48-inch long fluorescent tube, and you've calculated naively you put 40 watts of energy into it per second. 40 joules per second, 40-watt rate. Because of this negative characteristic, and because you're putting in a very nonlinear waveform, your simple calculation of 40 watts might turn out to be 400 watts. And there's a slim chance you're going to explode that tube. So in the case of a nonlinear device, a plasma device, a discharge plasma device, which is what fluorescent lighting is, that ballast transformer, that inductor, tries to maintain constant current, irrespective of voltage. And by this pulsing generator you've got, if it doesn't have some kind of a current limiting circuit to it, it could create some grief. Let's see if you first got that concept, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes, absolutely, Dick. In fact, the gaseous regulators that we used to use years ago, they work basically on the same principle. As that voltage went up, that current increased drastically to bring that voltage down. I know about those.
I have only three additional questions for that subject. One of them is, isn't that mechanism also responsible for the survival of the tubes or transistors when you use the single sideband mode, as we don't have a constant duty cycle, constant signal, they're loading into the transistors or tubes?
Yeah, you can take a 100 watt transistor running single sideband, and under certain conditions you may be able to make peak envelope power of 200 watts and only dissipate 100 watts of it, because normal speech has a certain duty factor to it. You run Morse code through there and key down for 1 second, and you're going to create some damage. But because of duty factor effects, you can get instantaneous power out of a tube that's considerably greater than the CW power capability of the device. So transistors and lots of things have this. As long as it still is linear at that peak envelope power rating, as long as it's properly impedance matched, it's got the right voltage and the right drive and whatever, and as long as you're doing it for a brief enough period of time, there are people who will take a single sideband transmitter that with normal speech is capable of putting out 100 watts peak envelope power and doing it very nicely. And then they start running some of these digital modes where you're transmitting continuous tones, where the duty factor of speech now got raised to the 100% duty factor of these tones, and you can create damage. So you got to be careful with these things. So lots of gun diodes, for instance, operate on principles like this. They can produce brief pulses where the total dissipation, let me drop it. The diode itself maybe can only dissipate 3 watts. And for brief periods of time, you can make it dissipate 30 watts. As long as the duty factor is low enough, as long as the specific heat of the junction is large enough, as long as the thermal time constant is big enough, if you know what I mean. So within reason, sometimes you can exceed the ratings if you do it for brief enough periods of time. N2XJN, K2LAW.
N2XJN. So my understanding is that DC represents resistance, not impedance. If we deliver as a modulation of that DC, only DC with no offset on it, so that we will be positive, we need impedance matching device to the load.
I think there's a little bit more to this. Depending on the design of the filter that I used in my previous example, the very first element of the filter might be an inductor from center conductor to ground on the input connector of the filter. There are certain filter designs that are like that. And as long as you're putting an AC signal through the filter at the right frequency, no problem. Works like a charm. But if now I'm taking that plus and minus 1 volt square wave, which has 1 volt of offset, so it goes to plus 2 volts and down to zero, which means it now has an average of plus 1 volt. And I take that waveform, no matter what impedance matching I do, I take that waveform and I put it into that filter. I'm putting 1 volt across that input inductor, and if that input inductor has a DC resistance of 1/10 of an ohm, I have just created a continuous current flow through that inductor of 10 amperes. And probably it's going to go up in smoke. So when you've got DC coming out of a signal generator, you have to really worry about the topography of the components inside the thing that you're about to feed. And some of the filter designs have a short circuit inductor right at the input connector. And it's not going to tolerate DC, no matter what impedance matching you do. So you got to look a little bit deeper in cases like that. You got to be careful when there's DC voltage on the center conductor of a cable. It can do damage when you connect it to certain circuits. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Square wave has AC components when it's offset. And what is the most common shape of AC component is that sine wave utilized to make DC pulse, or is the spike ripple only? Now, in both cases, one when you have an offset zero, one when you have a 50% offset.
No, that's not right.
Now, what are you saying, John?
If we don't have an offset, we have basically an AC signal. He's confusing that terminology. And if we have a pulse generator, we are dealing with an AC component no matter what. If we want to offset it, then we're dealing with a DC component. So he's got that little backwards.
Now you got to be a little bit careful. There are some brands of pulse generators you can buy where all the pulses it produces are positive going, even if the pulses are brief, and in between is zero. If your pulse generator makes only positive going events, there is a DC component present, even though it may not say so. And so, in certain kinds of circuits, that could give you grief. So you really got to look at the AC component and the DC component as two separate components, two separate characteristics that will obey the laws of superposition. You can find out how your circuit is going to behave to AC. You can find out how your circuit is going to behave to DC, You can study each of those events independently, and in some cases you can then predict what's going to happen when you combine the two. But there's a catch. If somewhere in my circuit I have an inductor with, say, a magnetic core to it, and I test the AC characteristics of my circuit, and I like what it does. I test the DC characteristics of my circuit, and maybe it doesn't burn anything up. But now I combine the AC and the DC simultaneously, because the DC component might saturate the core of that inductor, and it now has a brand new inductance in Henry's. That AC component I previously mentioned isn't true anymore. The AC characteristic of my filter network, say. So you got to go a little bit slow on these things. In that particular case, you could say that it doesn't meet the law of superposition. Let me drop. The law of superposition is very true if and only if all your components are always thoroughly linear components. Then the circuit will obey the law of superposition. But in case of an inductor, where when DC current flows through it, you get partial saturation of the core, and it comes up with a brand new inductance, usually lower in value, I no longer have a circuit that obeys superposition. I don't have linear components. I have saturatable components. That's not linear anymore. So the circuit might be very linear for all reasonable values of AC signals, and the circuit can become nonlinear when there's a DC component present. There are transistor circuits, there are LC networks, there are all kinds of circuits that don't necessarily obey superposition. So you got to be careful. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, it was the last question of mine. I was just, I didn't articulate it properly. What I was wanted to know is, as a product of a DC pulse with no offset, and DC pulse with the offset, are we going to see spikes, ripples only? Are we going to see the sine wave as a component of that, or the product of that structure?
If I was going into an ideal spectrum analyzer that has a good RF attenuator on the front end, so that very little of the DC component gets to that first mixer, but there's a lot of gain downrange, so it's all being compensated, and I now measure the spectrum of a square pulse that's no DC offset or a square pulse that's got DC offset, that AC-coupled spectrum analyzer will show no difference in spectrum. And if the spectrum analyzer really does go down to DC, and I don't have an AC coupled, but I've got an attenuated spectrum analyzer, it will show a great big vertical line at the left-hand side of the screen representing zero signal. That's the DC component. So there are kinds of spectrum analyzers that will let you know by the display on that screen whether or not you've got an offset square wave or a symmetric square wave. There are kinds of spectrum analyzers that let you see that. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you very much, Dick, for covering this subject so deeply. It was very interesting and was very much educating. Now, there were so many additional things that come up from that, and it's the next step in the learning process. Now, I don't know if you had a chance to see the video that I have sent you. I have sent I have purchased and sort of tested Studart 50 ohms impedance turret attenuator. John would be able to explain to you the mechanical structure better. So if John could pick up, I would appreciate that.
KG2WGB. Yes, Dick, if you do look at the diagram or that photo he sent you, it looks like a revolver, similar to a pistol. I'm sure you've seen them before. And it's a very interesting switching device that he purchased there, an attenuator. If you look at that, then you'd be able to answer any of his questions. Looks like a nice little piece of equipment.
I plugged it to the vector network analyzer, and I was able to see on the Smith chart how it reacts. Although I'm not the best in reading that, I saw that the circles on the Smith chart were decreasing in the size to the very, very small dot, and when attenuation was close to zero, I saw that it didn't even match to the scale. Ladies and gentlemen,
I own that exact device.
Wow. Okay. Now, there was another measurement tool that was present all the time, and that was line magnitude. I'm not very much familiar with that, but it was changing. Now, when I put the scale on it, all of a sudden the circular pattern of the Smith chart, which would be considered all of a sudden changed to the coin, and I was surprised. Polar. So I switched to Smith chart. Instead of showing me Smith chart, it shows me polar. But I knew that I was in Smith chart. Then when I had that attenuation 1:1 and didn't match the scale, so it shows me the square. Then I put the scale. All of a sudden, that pattern changed to the conic one, like the one that I see in the Smith chart. And sometimes I have that it actually switch in not only to the one conic one, but like in two conic one in the reverse of 90 degrees, left and right. So if you could explain that, Andrew Exchange.
Look more like a spiral, Dick.
Okay, the Saturn step attenuator that I own, you take the knob on the front panel, you pull it toward you, you rotate to whichever attenuator you want. You can select 0, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, and 60, as I remember, in 10 dB steps. And then you push the knob back in, and the input connector and the output connector of that particular cylindrical attenuator, you've now made contact. It's as if you had a whole bunch of individual attenuators sitting on the table with a type N female connector on each end, and you unscrew the two pieces of cable, left side and right side, and choose the right one, 0 to 60 dB of attenuation, and plug it back in. So whether you're screwing connectors onto a real attenuator, or you're pushing and pulling the knob on this Stoddard step attenuator, this turret attenuator, you're doing the same thing. Let me drop. And now, if I'm using the network analyzer in the so-called S21 mode, I'm measuring forward voltage transfer characteristic, and I'm displaying that either as a polar chart or as a Smith chart. Well, when it comes to forward voltage transfer characteristic, S21, almost every network analyzer will display that as a polar chart. If I was displaying input impedance, S11, unless you asked for something special, it will automatically display that as a Smith chart. Now, in the case of a properly calibrated network analyzer, and I set the Stoddard in the I'm measuring S21, and I'm plugging in the Stoddard at the 0 dB setting, the polar chart is such that the center of the chart, the dot in the very center, represents 0 volts. The outer perimeter represents unity, 1 volt, we'll say. And if I'm sweeping in frequency, because the Stoddard has a certain physical length to it, let me drop. In other words, when I did the calibrating of the network analyzer, I did it by bringing the two pieces of cable together, probably with a bullet connector, and I calibrated so that the network analyzer gives you a single line between center and 12 o'clock. That might be the way you calibrated it, or 0 and 9 o'clock. There's various ways you can calibrate it. And now when I put the Stoddard in there, the Stoddard has more physical length than the bullet that I used to connect the two cables. The more physical length means that the signal, as I go from the lowest frequency to the highest frequency, if I sweep wide enough, I'm now going to get a phase shift. But if the Stoddard is set at 0 dB, the dot will go out to the perimeter at 12 o'clock, and it will sweep as I go up in frequency toward 3 o'clock, toward 6 o'clock, toward 9 o'clock. It's going to make a circle. If I sweep wide enough in frequency, because of the extra length of the Stoddard, I'm going to get a unity circle out at the perimeter of the chart. You could then, if you want to, go to the offset settings of the network analyzer and tell it that the device on the test has 5 inches of length. And if you did that, that circle on the outside would turn into a dot at, say, 9 o'clock or 12 o'clock, depending on how you set it. Now when I go, before I did that offsetting that I just described, where I've got a circle on the outside, I pull the knob on the Stoddard toward me, rotate one click, and now I've now got 10 dB of attenuation. Let me drop. With 10 dB of attenuation, that's roughly one-third voltage. I plug it back in, I do the display, and now I get a circle on the polar chart that is roughly one-third the radius from the center toward the perimeter. And it will be a pure circle if the Stoddard had 10 dB of attenuation at exactly all of those frequencies. If the Stoddard has a little bit more attenuation at higher frequencies than lower frequencies, then that one-third diameter circle will become a little bit of a spiral. It'll start spiraling inward a little bit. So the amplitude of the, I could put markers on there, and the amplitude of the polar chart, in other words, the distance from center to each of these dots, so to speak, or each of these markers, tells me what is the attenuation of that frequency, and where it is on the chart, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, tells me how much phase shift there was because of the extra electrical length of the Stoddard compared to the bullet that I used during calibration. I wonder if that so far makes some sense. Let me try both of you guys. John first, KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Absolutely, Dick. Now it does make sense because I saw the video. I didn't really know what was going on there, but now what you explained is definitely what I saw there. I don't know if he calibrated. You'll have to check that out, Wesley. You'll have to let me know. I didn't know if you had calibrated. But also, you couldn't explain that other green line.
Yeah, the green line was called line magnitude and was bending. Either from flat, it was bending. But then I used another tool. I used line magnitude and real, and then line magnitude and imaginary. Now, the real and imaginary look alike, but they represent something like a sort of sine wave that was changing the amplitude. So I could see the line magnitude bending. When it was bent the most, the attenuation was zero, or was the smallest one. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if the device on the test that's being connected to the network analyzer is being tested into forward voltage transfer characteristic, which is called S21, I can now decide to display it in about four different ways. The polar chart is what I've been describing up till now, or a rectangular chart. In the case of the rectangular chart, I can display that in two different ways. I can display it as decibels vertical versus frequency horizontal. And if I set that for 0 dB of attenuation on the Stoddard, I would get a straight blue line across the top of the screen, a straight horizontal line. And if I plug in 10 dB of attenuation, and if I've got the vertical screen set for 10 decibels per box vertical, the blue line will come down one box and be a straight horizontal blue line. If the Stoddard had a little bit more insertion loss at the high frequency versus the low frequency, then the blue line will slant downward slightly, and maybe your Stoddard might have 10 dB of attenuation at 100 megacycles, and maybe at 15 gigahertz, instead of having 10 dB of attenuation, it has 12 dB of attenuation. So the line would slope down by 2 dB in power versus frequency display. Let me drop. But the polar plot and the power plot in decibels are both combining the real and imaginary components in the square root of the sum of the square mathematics. It's telling you the total power transferred. Now you can display real and imaginary. You can display the individual in-phase and quadrature components by the real and phase display. If your device under test was a complicated filter, and what real filters have is a certain amount of electrical length inside, but the electrical length changes as a function of frequency. That's what filters do. Most filters have the minimum electrical length at the center frequency, and as you go to the upper 3 dB roll-off frequency or the lower 3 dB roll-off frequency, the electrical length gets longer. The signal takes a little longer to get through the filter when you're at the roll-off frequencies. That phenomena is called group delay distortion. Properly displayed on a spectrum on a network analyzer screen, it'll give you a Greek letter mu-shaped curve. It'll give you a bathtub-like curve where at the upper and lower roll-off frequencies, you'll see the curve peak up when the network analyzer is properly calibrated for that particular average length of filter. And to properly calibrate a network analyzer, let me drop. You have to tell it ahead of time, I want you to start at this frequency. I want you to stop at that frequency. I want you to go from F1 to F2 with 256 steps. That's one of the choices you can make. 256, 512, 1024, and so on. The more steps you make, the finer is the resolution of the display, but it takes longer to update. So it's a trade-off between resolution and time. And you then, in order to do the calibration procedure, you tell it what frequency to start, what frequency to stop, how many steps to make, and then you have to put onto the port 1 cable. At the end of that cable, you have to put first a perfect 50-ohm load, then a perfect short circuit, and a perfect open circuit. And on the J2 cable, short circuit, open circuit, and perfect load. And then between the two cables, a perfect throughput device, which could be a bullet adapter. So the complete calibration procedure is a total of 7 steps of putting on load, short, and open on each cable, plus a throughput device. And now you have calibrated the network analyzer for that particular length of the throughput device. And if your device on the test is some other length, then you've got to do some further offsetting if you want to get a most easily understood display. The whole procedure of calibrating a network analyzer is a little bit lengthy, and there's a lot of spooky stuff to it, and it's got a significant learning curve. You have to teach the network analyzer what is the length of each of your two test cables. Let me drop. What you're really doing during that total calibration procedure is you're teaching the network analyzer what is the length of each of your two cables, what is the insertion loss of your two cables, what are the impedance bumps of your two cables. You're teaching the network analyzer during the calibration procedure You're teaching it all of the characteristics of your test cables. And if it's done just right, all of the characteristics of your test cables are cranked back out of the measurement. And what's left is the measurement of the device under test. But you've got to have a calibrated set of shorts, opens, and terminations. You have to have a calibration kit to really do that correctly. You don't have to, but if you want to get results that are traceable to the Bureau of Standards, you have to have a pretty expensive calibration kit. A smart ham radio operator can set up a BNC or a type N connector with a short and open and one with a perfect 50 ohm termination. He can use much lesser calibration devices and get results that are pretty good. Not perfect, but good enough for ham radio purposes. Let's see if that created some questions, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. I remember talking to you about the calibration kits a couple of weeks ago. And, yeah, they are expensive. I also talked to Glenn about it, too, and he said if it's below 10 megahertz, almost any calibration kit would work. But if you get above that, you got to have the specific one for that. And you had pointed out that what I didn't know, that specific short and open had to be well-designed to meet that criteria. And that was an interesting note on that situation. Over to you, Dick.
Who we owe, Dick?
Rich recognized. Let me drop for a beep. I think Glenn is being a little bit too severe when he says at 10 megacycles. With good ham radio practices and careful...
He said 10 gig.
Okay, now I agree. Well, now he's too liberal. With good ham radio practices, you and I could make homebrew in our shop. Very good calibration kit that I would trust to at least a gigahertz. And if I was super careful with a microscope, yes, I could get it to work to 10 gigahertz. But the short and the open has to have a certain electrical length between the connector front panel of the connector of the calibrating device and the real internal short or open. There's a certain length that has to be there that you either measure and you tell it to the network analyzer, or there's a standard length that the network analyzer assumes, and hopefully you've made it the same length. It might be, I don't know what the number is, it might be 15, or it might be 7 millimeters downrange from the front panel connector of the calibrating device is where the real shorter open exists. In the case of the 50 ohm termination, the length doesn't matter. The hardest part is making a short that doesn't have any stray inductance. It's not so difficult to make a open that doesn't have stray capacitance. That's pretty easy. And to make a 50 ohm termination that is really flat 50 ohms from 0 to 10 gigs. You might want to buy a commercial one of those. You don't want to homebrew that. And good terminations, properly bought, are not that expensive. So making a cal kit is not too bad. I think a smart ham could do that for $20, and 19 of those dollars is going to be for the 50 ohm termination, and the rest of the money is going to be spent on the actual connectors themselves that you've got to buy. You go out and buy a real cal kit, high quality, made by the Murray Microwave Company, good to 10 or 20 gigahertz, and you're going to spend $8,000. You guys don't need...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You guys definitely don't need a cal kit of anywhere near that quality, and spending $8,000 would be, in my point of view, fairly wasteful. N2EL, what's your question, Rich? K2RIW?
Okay, Dick, 2RIW and 2EO. Well, I'll give you some idea, Dick. A really, really poor man's network analyzer that any ham can use and afford. Believe it or not, I think we went over this, but I'll give you some more information. An MFJ antenna analyzer. I think even MFJ didn't know it could be used as a network analyzer. I'll tell you what I was able to do. Let me let it drop. The MFJ, I think number is 269, it goes to like 450 megahertz. When I redesigned
Ameritron AL1500 and put the second tube in. As you recall, I told you I had to redo the tank circuit because with two tubes in parallel, the plate impedance was now half of what it originally was. So what I did was I took with the amplifier totally shut down, power off, I knew that the plate impedance was about 2,000 ohms per tube, so 1,000 ohms for two tubes. Actually, I turned the filament on, okay? The filament was on, the tubes were plugged in. I put a 1,000 ohm resistor temporarily from the plate to ground, jammed the antenna relay shut into the transmit position, and put the analyzer into the output. I was unable to tune in per band, 14 megahertz, 21 megahertz, and dial up the analyzer and adjust the Pi network coil until I got a one-to-one match. And it worked out right on the money. Let me have a reset. This is an idea I got from Hal, K6DPZ. He's the one that came up with it. Now, yesterday I was working on a Kenwood R599D, which is a receiver that I'm storing, and I was having trouble with the input circuit. I put some parts from a junker into a good receiver, and I had my doubts if everything was working right. So Hal was over, we were eating together, and he said, hey, jam the analyzer into the receiver input of the R599. Sure enough, I did that. Dialed up the preselector to the proper band and could see a one-to-one match, or very close to it, at 14 megs. As I tuned the preselector, you could see the match changing. Went to the next band, checked it out, and I knew that the front end was good. So there's an example of how to use an MFJ-269 as a poor man's network analyzer that anybody can afford. Back to you, Dick, until we have.
Yeah, that's pretty crafty. A nice way of adjusting that Ameritron with the two tubes. And network analyzers are now getting a little bit more available on the surplus market, eBay and places like that. And some of the early ones made by Hewlett-Packard are not easy to use. They were pretty user hostile. The more modern ones have pretty smart microprocessors inside that do a lot of the calculating and adjusting and calibrating for you. And so how many amateurs really need a high-class network analyzer is an interesting question. If a major club like Limark, with 350 members, went and bought one and then loaned it to various members, they'd get some good payback on that. Or bought a good service monitor and loaned it to the various members, they'd get some good payback on that. For any one member to own either of those instruments, he might not get a chance to use it enough if he's not in business to get return on investment. KT2WGB, K2RIW.
I have a lot of fun with my network analyzers and my spectrum analyzers. I have about seven now. They're all used for different things, but I enjoy them. But that's very interesting, Dick. When I spoke to Glenn, he wasn't talking about homebrew. He was talking about any of the ones on eBay that are made by a major manufacturer. Any of those calibration kits would probably work for the work that we do. He said he didn't think we'd have to worry about it.
Yeah, I agree with that. But up to a couple of gigahertz, you could, with care, homebrew them. I've done that. I was using, a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, I was working on a project that had very miniature connectors, MMCX connectors. Remember that tiny little connector that used to be on the edge of the plug-in card that you put into your laptop computer, the PCMCIA card? And there's a little bit of an RF output connector on the outside edge of that plug-in card. That is an MMCX connector. I needed a CAL kit for MMCX for the work that I was doing, and I homebrewed one, and it came out good enough. I was doing work at 900 megs, and it worked good enough. So you can homebrew those connectors. I know that earlier, John, you said you had a question you wanted to ask tonight. KC2WGB.